I want to introduce our next speaker to you, and I start with a little story. Our next speaker is Thomas Steininger. And where do I start? In the estuary movement, we are trying to connect our ongoing conversations also to local communities. And because, you know, we are all in this English-speaking space, and like the whole world is increasingly in this English-speaking internet. And we also, here in Germany, we have a German-speaking sub-community. And we also have in Mannheim our monthly estuary meetup. And this is, of course, happening in German. And we think it's important to translate what's going on in this space into your own context. And when I think back my own story, I started with these Petersen videos on my own, and I then connected to David, and we started to talk, the two of us, about it. And I was since then always looking for German media and publications who are aware of this or who could comment on this. And that was happening in this space, in this little corner of the internet. And I was always searching, does anybody know of what's happening here? Does anybody know in Germany about John Verbeke, about Jonathan Peugeot, about Paul Vanderclay? And also, are churches aware of what is happening? And I think German churches are still not aware of what's happening here. And then one day on my internet search, I found something called Evolve Magazine. And there I found some articles about John Verbeke, about the meaning crisis. And I said, wow, okay, here's a German publication. And I think you could say that Evolve Magazine is the first German media and publication who got aware of this and who reported on this little corner. And I thought, okay, I need to contact those guys. And I wrote to Thomas, who is the editor of Evolve Magazine, in Frankfurt in Germany. And Thomas also has a PhD in philosophy, and he's hosting these dialogical practices in Frankfurt and all over Germany. And and he was immediately open and interested in what is happening here in the space. And he also, after we connected, he wrote a short article about our Mannheim community, what's happening here. And as we said, it's very important to connect this to local communities, and that's also why we invited Thomas today. We want to get into dialogue with different communities, and like Thomas's speech is going to be in two parts. The first part is an introductory speech, and afterwards we'll have a short break, and we will rearrange the chairs because it will be something like a fishbowl method, and Thomas is going to explain what exactly that means. Yeah, and that's basically his introduction, and please have a warm welcome for Thomas Steininger.
Thank you. And thank you, Paul, for your input. There's a lot to respond to, and a lot at stake with me. One thing I would like to start with, because it stood out for me, and forgive me if I do it in my own words. When you went through the different Christian churches, the Orthodox, the Catholic, and the Lutheran, and how the focus point of their relationship to the sacred is in the liturgy, is in the Eucharist, and is in the teaching. And basically, the punchline is that maybe something else is waiting along the line. That's my understanding of it. And that kind of really landed with me. And what you do with estuary, obviously, all together, but what's happening all over the place. I mean, I learned John Verbeke because of our shared interest in dialogical spaces, what he calls dialogos, what we call emergent interbeing. And there are all kind of places where things like this is happening. One of the question that is kind of with me quite a while, what's going on globally that this is the case? And one way of understanding, and it's just one way, but I think that there's something to it. Something happened in the industrial world in the last 50 years, mainly talking about Europe and the US, of course, Japan and other industrial states. There was a kind of a revolution that surprised me, that I would call the mindfulness revolution. And you see that techniques like meditation are to have them 30 years ago, 50 years ago on the front line of the front page of the Time magazine or the Spiegel would be completely impossible. We just had a Spiegel front page about meditation and yoga, and a lot happened, and even big companies like Google, basically, it's just a given that meditation is something that, I mean, you have different ways how you can relate it. It's just basically a form of focusing, relaxing, but often it's also a way to leave the unimportant behind and come to something meaningful in your life. And it is a different relationship to reality, because basically what you do with a meditation, at least one thing that I would like to highlight is you have, and I'm going a little Weberian here, you go beyond the subject-object relationship in reality. It's not me having a relationship to you. Basically, the whole thing about practices like meditation is, when you said basically let your thought goes, let your thought process that relates you with the objectified world go, and whatever that means, just be. And there's something where the particular relationship to reality where we relate very much in an objectified way about everything that comes with modernity is in a crisis or is on the verge of pushing to something different. At least it's happening. But it seems there's something additional happening. When you brought Harris in, he is one of the representatives of this meditation paradigm, and he kind of makes the point that, I mean, he's really deeply into meditation, but he at the same time is completely into the naturalist objectified relationship to reality, and he tries to bring this two together. What happens with these dialogical spaces and these spaces is, I think, that people also seem to expand this mindfulness revolution to not just sit on their cushion and meditate or do something on their own, but to be in a different way together and find different ways of meaning creation. So that we come together in a dialogical space where meaning is something we share, shared meaning. In your invitation to this conference, you kind of made the point, I don't know exactly how you brought it, that we all on the path of meaning finding. And you wrote in this short introduction that everyone in the end finds their own meaning. And I agree with that, and I want to expand it a little bit, because it's not just my own meaning. If it's really meaningful to me, it's a shared meaning. It's a meaning that I share with others. Because that's kind of, I think, when we talk about meaning crisis, as John would put it out, one is a sense of meaningless on my own. So that is part where I just feel there's nothing to this. But there's another dimension of this meaning crisis, that we can't agree on a meaning. And that is something that is very core to my heart and to the work that we're doing, both with our emergent interbeing work, our dialogical work, and the magazine and the webcast. The way I pose the question, how can we find meaning in an open society? How can we find shared meaning in an open society? How can we find meaning together in an open society without, and the way I usually phrase it, and my original Catholic background comes through, without a pope and 10 commandments tell us how to find this. So how can we be busy also adults, citizens, who out of their own free relationship to reality are able to together find a meaningfulness relationship to this global world, because otherwise we are in big troubles. So how to do that? And my assumption is that maybe the sacrament for this is meaningful conversations. And insofar, I have never thought about it in the way you brought it before, kind of putting the liturgy in the Orthodox Church, putting the Eucharist in the Catholic Church, putting the teaching and the word in the Lutheran and Calvinist church as a different focus point on the sacred, and the question that maybe there's something else that is needed right now, and that is maybe about in the context of meaningful conversations. But I find it very attractive. I find this very attractive and very dear to my heart, and I find it another sign that something is bubbling in the, if I may use a German English word, Zeitgeist. that is looking for finding to come away to come through. That's how I interpret it. And I would like to really emphasize how, in a global society that is not kind of a authoritarian society or even a kind of church dictatorship of some sort, or some, how can we find ways, not a perfect way, but ways to create enough meaning that we come through this civilizational crisis that we are together in. And for that, I think also it's helpful, at least it's my, a take that I find helpful to look a bit to the word meaning and meaningfulness. When I find something meaningful, this is a Vivekian move on this, I feel home somewhere. Finding meaning is a form of homing. Or the other way around, when nothing makes sense, I feel very alienated. In whatever world I'm in, if I feel very... it doesn't make sense, I just don't feel home in that. And even more so, when I really go deeper into what does meaningful mean in the end, there's some things, at least in my experience, that I find so deeply, and I don't mean primarily intellectual meaningful, but existential meaningful, that maybe literal, but at least as an image, brings me to my knees. So something that is so meaningful, and there are different things that come immediately to my mind that are so meaningful to me that it brings me to my knees. Because there's something that is, here's the word, sacred to me. So there's a deep relationship between sacredness and meaningfulness. And my claim would be my more secular heart prefers to talk about meaningfulness, also because there are more people you can talk to. But closer to my heart, what is more meaningfulness is also to appreciate the deep sense of the meaningfulness of life, which I would also call the sacredness of life. And what maybe is needed is a conversation in all kind of forms, but a human-to-human conversations. And it seems that part of why this happening was happening, that we have a completely new way how we can have intimate conversations globally all of a sudden through Zoom. I take Zoom as standing for this technological possibility. It doesn't have to be Zoom. Where we do this all the time, this corner of the internet that you come from, or that you created, that you co-created, emerged where all of a sudden people are also kind of hooked on. What brings them to be hooked at? My claim would be, or my interpretation is, because their thirst for meaningfulness shows up there in this conversation, and also a thirst to participate in this conversation of meaningfulness. And in that, how do we orchestrate this kind of conversations? What John talks about ecology of practices is very much related to that, because he makes the point basically that conversation is not about the prepositional part of conversations, but a lot of other parts. You know, I don't have to go into this. In my words, he wouldn't say that. It also has to be existential in a way that we do that. And there's something that came out in the conversation that we had online that John would not, to some degree, he's emphasizing that. When he's talking about wisdom culture, he's making the point that the only wisdom culture that we as a human race have developed are our wisdom traditions. Our religions. Because in modernity, we created something which is a very interesting and problematic split, a split between knowing and wisdom. And we basically emphasized our kind of scientific understanding of reality, what is factual or what is calculable, but it's far away of what is meaningfulness. And one point that John also very powerful makes that attaining wisdom or learning wisdom has something very different than attaining knowledge in that sense that it changes you. It's an insight that changes you that you have to rise up to in order to be open up to what wisdom really is about. And I just, one could say more, but wisdom, of course, has a lot to do with a right relationship to the sacred and a right relationship to the reality of my and our life that we are living in that case. So what I try to bring out is there are all these traditions that over thousands of years, with all pitfalls and a lot of shadow sides and whatever, and shortages and maybe also historically outdated parts, it developed capacities to create a relationship to a shared wisdom. And I had an interesting experience just a couple of weeks ago. In my work, I am very interested in different ways of the wisdom traditions. I kind of the last 2 years threw myself deeply into understanding of Muslim culture and Muslim wisdom. Right now, I'm going completely in the other way in my research work, in my existential research work, and I go very much into something that's far away from our world, is the Shinto religion. Because Shinto religion, in my understanding, Shinto religion and Islam are on the contrary part of the spectrum. Islam is as much as you can get only and only and only oneness. That the whole point of Trinity is a deadly sin in Islam out of that reason, because it's against the oneness. Shintoism is a very interesting thing because it's basically at least the only culture that I'm aware of where in the period of at least 5,000 years and now modern, postmodern states kind of developed a form of animism that is only really oriented about the plurality of what is called in Japan kami, the spirits, in everything and everything. All is just basically the relationship to the sacred in its multiplicity of the spirit of this place, the spirit of this room, my spirit, my ancestors, the spirit of the tree out there. That's basically what Shintoism is. Completely, I mean, from the Islam point of view, you couldn't really go worse in there. So you see these different relationships. In a couple of weeks ago, I visited friends of mine in Austria. A friend of mine, I can call him a friend. It's a little pretentious to call him a friend, but he's a friend. Maybe some of you know Brother David Steindl Rust. He's a Benedictine monk who lived many years, most of his time in California. worked in Esalen a lot and is now back in his Austrian monastery. He's 97 right now. And for me, if there's someone who kind of manifests for me the character of a Catholic saint, that's him. And the kind of people, even when you just spend half an hour in your life with them, you feel blessed afterwards, and you don't really know why. For me, it's that. So they have a little monastery in the Lake District in Salzburg, Austria, where they created a Benedictine monastery, but very different to this monastery that they're usually in Austria, because usually they are huge and baroque and everything. This is a converted farmhouse, and it was built 30 years ago. It's built basically to resurrect also the old monastic tradition. And I went there for a couple of days and joined them also for the 5 daily prayers that they do. And what became aware for me is, first I was impressed by the character of the personality of the monks, just powerful people, but I was aware also that I'm not just only present of this, they're just 6 monks. They have a bigger community around them, but the monks are just 6. I'm not just in the presence of them, I'm in the presence of a whole tradition. And that's different than being in the presence of 5 or 6 powerful spiritual beings. That's powerful too, but there's a dimension that they hold not as an individual, they hold as a partaker of a spiritual tradition that is 2,000 years old, or 1,500 years old, to be precise, in that. And that brought me also to the insight, again, how when we have a dialogue about meaningful conversations in an open society, where we kind of talk in the plurality of our open global society that we live in, it's not just us as an individual who have these conversations, it's also us as traditions who have these conversations, and they are different, but they're beautiful, and I have to say something. And I really honor the differences in that, because in this couple of years that I really dove into Muslim spirituality, there's something, for example, that really stuck out and became meaningful for me, if I may say in a blasphemic way, they liberated me somehow also from Christianity. In that sense, because the Quran tells the story of the paradise, similar like the Bible does. Adam, Eve, the apple, and everything. But there is a huge difference in the way the Quran tells the story than the Bible tells the story. That is, God forgave Adam and Eve. He forgave them, and there is no original sin. Which gave me, being from a Catholic, coming from a Catholic background, I saw this whole guilt cult in the Catholic Church, which, by the way, I find not only problematic, there's also a beautiful side to it, but there's also at least has been a problematic side to this. And I see how there's a tradition who deals with that in a very different ways. Or other example that I find fascinating, that because of the relationship of the Godfather and the Godson, we usually have a relationship of where, in the Christian context, of where we are children of God in that. And I found out that in a Muslim context, people who are really close to God, what we would call saints, they don't emphasize the childrenhood of God, they are friends of God. That's the, I don't know what the Arab name is, but they're called friends of God. Which is a very different relationship if you say, and I'm not even saying what is better, but the difference of that. And there are these traditions and they are alive and they have so much experience about our human relationship to the sacred. And there is also, which I, if I may call it this way, the secular traditions, where we just emphasize our human dignity in our adulthood as being free participants in a democratic process, creating reality in the future together in a way that is rational and kind of eye to eye. And in that, can we have a conversation where all this individually and the traditions can come together in a way that we find ways of not creating identity? Because I think if we would create identity and understanding, we would lose even something of the multiplicity and the beauty and everything. But mutual understanding. If I, and that's part of, by the way, the reason why I really like silent meditation as a practice, because I can dive into something or I can even meditate with someone. And if you come out of the meditation and he or she who's meditating with me and is touched by the same that I'm touched with, calls that Allah and I call it what I call it, we contextualize it differently, but we are also we are touched by the same thing in that. So there is something where we can create practices where we know that the meaningfulness, the sacredness, is something that holds us together and differentiates us at the same time. And maybe in that sense, if we find practices of doing this, the open society that is mainly defined as a secular society can open itself also up to the sacred dimension. Because I find it kind of strange when I think about the secular, the open society, that the main way, open society and the equivalent, the secular society, that we usually don't relate this to the sacred at all. And why? If it's open, why is it not open to the sacred? It's an interesting question. So how can this be done? I would think there's something we can learn from the mindfulness practice. What I mean is really not being fooled with my assumptions of something or even thinking of something, but being mindfulness of the presence that I'm aware of the presence that we are aware of. And if I may use just us here, as we are here together, we are coming from different backgrounds. I'm sure that when we share our stories, you share some of them. They are very different, but there is a possibility, or in fact it already started, that we create a shared meaning field of this weekend, where to some degree we share something together that we together find meaningful. And this is more a phenomenological experience. I don't think, maybe it can't really define what I'm in, but I'm aware that I'm something together with you in. I'm not separate, but maybe there's different things where I differ very much and I don't understand, but there's something I'm together with you in. And not only that I find it meaningful, I experience also that we together find it meaningful, and that there is a shared meaningful that we can investigate, go deeper, also disagree, but can participate in appreciation and respect for this meaningfulness, which does not mean at all the necessity to agree. It just means the necessity to appreciate that there is maybe the possibility of some understanding, some mutual understanding. If that's the case, something is opening up and a dynamic is opening up. That is, I think, what's happening in these meaningful conversations. That's what we are practicing in our different forms, how we do this. We are learning, or the evolution of humanity is learning how to do this. And this maybe could be also emphasized as being a form of a sacrament. And I would like to close it here, and the second part of these 2 hours that we have together, I would do something that we learned from a tradition that's called fishbowl, but I don't like the name of it. The way I like to call it, because it emphasizes also what part of the strength what this can do, mandala conversations. And I would like to change the setting of this room to create a couple of circles around an inner circle with 7 chairs in the inside. My request is I will sit in the inside circle, that some of you come right away to the inside circle so that it's kind of full, this 7 seats, with one request: one seat should be empty, and I tell you afterwards why. So I would suggest we make a break. How long do we need for a break? 10 minutes, 15 minutes?
Thank you very much.